Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Kill them. Kill them both. We're missing Antiques Roadshow.
We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Like magic, an invisible chain of sound once more circles the planet.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
You said I was an enemy of society? All right, I'll show you what I think of your society.
You're talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content. So if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 66. We're getting our kicks on number 66. This is Terry Frost. And in this very podcast, I'll be talking about two movies which have something to do with drunkenness. The first one is The Assassination Bureau Limited from 1970, starring Diana Rigg and that famous drunkard Oliver Reed. And the second one is a movie that I have really wanted to do for Paleo Cinema pretty much from day one. And it's only recently that it's become available at all. It's not available legally, but it is available through the usual torrent sites. And it's a 1983 Australian kind of comedy, drama, political satire called Goodbye Paradise, starring Ray Barrett as Michael Stacey, OBE, a former deputy police commissioner and drunkard. Anyway, how is everybody? The holiday season has ended. Well, not really, because you've got New Year's to come. But the Christmas Newton-mas thing has gone. I did eat a bit too much over the time I have had off, and today is the last of the 4 days that I have off. And I'm going to be making up for that from here on in. But, yeah, yesterday Sal and I drove, basically, we did about 600 kilometres. We drove up to New South Wales for lunch, as you do. And then cruised around the Murray River country for a little bit and came back again. So today I'm feeling a little bit tired. My back's a bit sore from sitting in the car and driving for most of the time. But we had a great time and it was good to get away. See some locust plagues. There were some plagues of locusts around, and we did collide with a few locusts in the car, which is always reminds me of the start of the Sands of the Kalahari, where the aeroplane hits a locust swarm and crashes in the Kalahari Desert. For some reason, I keep thinking that we're going to have to fight baboons for food and drink water out of ostrich eggs. But anyway, it was a good little day, Zephyr. And yeah, and I hear there's a lot of snowstorms around the US, particularly on the East Coast, where Vince from B-Movie Cast and, of course, Dr. Zom live. Hope you guys are staying out of the snow and don't have to resort to cannibalism to survive. But if you do, remember the tenderest meat is on the buttocks. Anyway, I'm going to just talk a little bit about what I have been watching. I did watch a movie that you might want to check out. It's a recent one. It's a 2009 French film called Largo Winch, L-A-R-G-O, next word, W-I-N-C-H. It's based on a very, very popular Belgian and French graphic novel or comic strip kind of thing about a guy called Largo Winch, whose adopted father is a billionaire. And in the story of the film, there's a whole bunch of political machinations to stop Largo from inheriting the fortune that his father has left him. And it's a good adventure film. There's some beautiful locations. The locations are stunning. The production values are great. The actor in the lead role, and I do forget his name, just let me get that for us. His name's Thomas Isley, and it is a 2008 movie, by the way. There is a sequel being produced with, again, Thomas Isley in it, but it's going to have Sharon Stone as one of the main antagonists. The first film had Kristen Scott Thomas, who has been doing some lovely roles in French cinema these days. She's always there as kind of like the aristocratic, beautiful, slightly aging woman who usually ends up being the villainess. But I do recommend it. There's a lot of good stunt work in this film, a lot of which Sisley does himself. And it's a cracking good adventure flick. It's a little bit Bourne, but without the flourishes that Paul Greengrass brought to the direction of that. But well worth checking out. And there is a really nasty knife and fist fight on top of a skyscraper in Hong Kong, which you might want to look out for. But if you can find a copy of that, definitely go with it. Have been told by various people that it's incredibly popular, particularly the graphic novel, and there was a TV series as well, incredibly popular in Europe, but nobody in the Anglophone world really has heard about it, which is a shame because it's a good saga. And that's pretty much the best thing I've been watching. I've been watching a lot of Eurospy stuff, nothing particularly memorable or wonderful, but I'll just try to go through some of it. I did see a 1966 kind of spy science fiction movie called Dimension 5 with Jeffrey Hunter and Frans Nguyen in it, which is kind of a little bit of fun, and it's a childhood pleasure that I've revisited there. I have acquired a bunch of copies of 1960s and 1970s James Coburn movies that I wasn't able to get previously. One of the BitTorrent sites that I go to, which you do need to get memberships for, is doing free downloads without any ratios on it. So I've been acquiring a bunch of that stuff, which I liked. And the other thing I've been watching is a TV pilot from 1986 called Condor, which stars Ray Wise, who you might remember from Twin Peaks and a bunch of other things. And it's supposed to have been set in 1999, so they've got humanoid robots and all sorts of other futuristic gadgetry, cars that drive themselves, all this kind of funky stuff. And it's a really interesting 1986 take on 1999, and it seems to show that mullets were still very popular in 1999, as well as blouson jackets. Yeah, those kind of puffy jackets with the sleeves rolled up that guys used to wear. Anyway, on to the movies that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the Assassination Bureau first, but before I do that, I'm going to take a little bit of a break. Got a slightly rough throat that I want to lubricate. And we'll get on with talking about the steampunky and very stylish Assassination Bureau Limited.
Yes, my friend, there's more to come. It keeps on going. Exactly so. You've been waiting for this number.
You haven't been here for a long time.
Yes, I've had a lot to do, you know.
Don't be so stubborn. Come on.
Oh, so you mean I should dance with you?
Yes, sweetie.
Huh?
Like it here?
Yes. It's hot. Olé! Oh, boy. You dance like a gym teacher, and you call this relaxing?
Yeah, here you really learn how to relax.
Yeah.
Don't you agree?
It's just warm.
Sometimes I find someone, but now I've got you, and I'll never let you go. I wouldn't think of it. I've waited much too long for you.
Oh, excuse me for a minute. I'll be right back.
All right, but don't stay too long.
Da, da, da. That was a track called Possessive Lesbian Bossa Nova by Jerry Van Ruyen from the soundtrack of Two Undercover Angels, otherwise known as Sadist Erotica. So I just thought I'd throw that in as a little bit of a surprise track. Ah, yes, so on with the Assassination Bureau Limited. I misspoke before. It's a 1969 film, not a 1970 film. Basically a comedy, romance, steampunky kind of thing. It was made, as I said, in 1969, directed by Basil Dearden, a director who did any number of other films. He's very badly spoken of in David Thompson's biographical dictionary of film. But I'll give you an idea of a few of the movies that he directed. And there are quite a few interesting ones. Victim, the 1961 film, starring Dirk Bogarde, which was about homosexuality and blackmailing homosexuals before it became legal in the UK. He directed that. He directed The League of Gentlemen, a 1959 film about a bank robbery, which is well worth watching. Violent Playground, a 1958 film starring Stanley Baker. The Smaller Show on Earth, which I recommend you see as well. I'm not going to tell you too much about that. It's one of those little films that you should check out. The Mindbenders, a 1963 film, again starring Dirk Bogarde, which was about mind control. I think I may have mentioned it in a previous podcast. Masquerade in 1965, Khartoum with Charlton Heston and Laurence Olivier in 1965. So, you know, he's got a bit of background there. This is the second last film that Basil Dearden made. He died in a car accident in 1971 on the M40 near London. And he made the last film he made was A Man Who Haunted Himself, a kind of ghostly, supernaturally kind of thing starring Roger Moore. But, you know, a good journeyman director. He's not the most fantastically wonderful director in the world, but he does the job quite well. So the stars, we've got Oliver Reed, who, of course, we know from any number of things, right up until Gladiator, his last film. Curse of the Werewolf for Hammer, and he kind of went through the Hammer thing with The Damned and moved on to Women in Love and all those other films that we know him for. Diana Rigg, who got her big kickstart in the TV series The Avengers, playing Emma Peel, and who quite soon after this film was made became one of the best Bond girls ever in On Her Majesty's Secret Service with George Lazenby. Very nuanced and lovely role, that one. Telly Savalas, playing a newspaper baron called Lord Bostwick, which I think it's odd for having a bald Greek playing an English newspaper baron in the early 20th century, but you kind of go along with it. Kurt Jurgens is in it. Philippe Noiret, a French actor for whom I have a lot of time. Warren Mitchell, an English actor, he's still alive too, who has done incredible character roles. So a lot of people in the UK and Australia remember him playing Alf Garnett until Death Us Do Part. But good actor. Beryl Reid's in there playing a brothel keeper in Paris. Beryl Reid, you might remember, in The Killing of Sister George. She was the older lesbian lady in that one. Let's see who we've got. Kenneth Griffiths in there. George Kalouris is in there as well. George Kalouris, a character actor with an incredibly long history. And you'd see him, you recognize his face. He was in part of Orson Welles' Mercury Theatre Company for a very long time. And had quite a history with Welles in there. He was in Citizen Kane, in fact. Other films he was in. Let's see what we've got there. A lot of English films, but the final program is in The Final Program. I talked about that, the Jerry Cornelius movie. He's in Papillon. He's in Murder on the Orient Express. He was on Shout at the Devil, quite a good action film with Lee Marvin and Roger Moore in it, which I maybe should do for a podcast at some stage. So, you know, you've got a really nice ensemble of character actors backing up the stars in this one. And it's a lovely little romp too. It's actually based on an unfinished novel by Jack London, which was finished later on by a thriller writer called Robert L. Fish. The script's by Basil Dearden, Michael Ralph, and Wolf Mackowitz. But I'll give you a bit of a plot idea, and then I'll play a little bit of I'll play the audio, then I'll give you the plot. So I'll play a little audio clip and get into the plot.
cannot deny, I suppose, that murder has its uses in society. But I must say that in the past, it has been pursued with more enthusiasm than accuracy. Explosive devices certainly went off, but usually in the wrong place, at the right time, or the right place at the wrong time. Quite suddenly, however, all this inefficiency became a thing of the past. Murders began to be committed with a sort of unholy precision. A comprehensive service was now being offered by the Assassination Bureau, Limited.
Okay, on with the praise of the film. The Assassination Bureau. In London during the early 1900s, aspiring journalist and women's rights campaigner Sonia Winter, played by Diana Rigg, uncovers an organisation that specialises in killing for money, the Assassination Bureau Limited. Thinking to bring about the destruction of the Bureau, she commissions the assassination of the Bureau's own chairman, Ivan Dragomilov, played by Oliver Reed. Far from being outraged or angry, Dragomilov is amused and delighted and decides to put it to his own advantage. The guiding principle of his bureau, founded by his father, has always been that there is a moral reason why the victim should be killed. These have included despots and tyrants. More recently, though, his elder colleagues have tended to kill more for financial gain than for moral reasons. Dragomilov therefore decides to accept the commission of his own death and challenge the other board members. Kill him or he will kill them. That's basically the outline of it. And Oliver Reed is one of those actors that I really like, but I feel sad about as well. I think alcohol did diminish his skills and his capabilities and unfortunately led to somewhat untimely death. And the legend of Oliver Reed, people tend to think of Oliver Reed first as an alcoholic and secondly as an actor, particularly in film buff circles, and I find that a bit sad. In this one, he is great. He does look like a brute. He's got that kind of brutish face with that heavy brow and the piercing eyes and that unfortunate scar that he got in a pub brawl just near the left-hand side of his mouth. But in this, he is a very charming character. He's charismatic, he's charming, he carries off the idea of a public school educated assassin very well, and he plays well off Diana Rigg as well. There's a nice to and fro between them, and the rapport seems to be good. I'm not sure whether the rapport was equally good off screen as on, but in this case, it does work incredibly well. And of course, you've got Telly Savalas as Lord Bostwick, the newspaper owner who is also one of the secret heads of the Assassination Bureau Limited, who hires Diana Rigg to investigate the Assassination Bureau Limited, thinking that by that way he can oust Dragomilov from the head position in the Bureau and take it over himself. And one of the things I do like about this film is the incredible detail in it. The set designs are fantastic and the period feel of it is fantastic. There are street scenes in it. There are scenes in a hat shop, which is actually one of the fronts for the Assassination Bureau Limited. And all of the people making hats are ostensibly blind, but not really. And they're all wearing dark sunglass kind of things, little round lens sunglasses, which brings a kind of spooky feel about it, which I really do appreciate. And of course, Diana Rigg's got that cut glass posh accent, which works well as a part of this. As the plot progresses too, we get to meet all the other members of the Assassination Bureau. There's a character actor called Bernard Dobchev, Clive Revel's in there as well, and basically it's a picturesque kind of travel through Europe as they go to Venice and Germany and a Parisian brothel where the Philippe Noiret is one of the members of the Bureau is want to frequent, and the brothel is a fantastic set. It's got this beautiful Art Nouveau look about it. All the doors have got beautiful Art Nouveau frameworks on them. And if you were ever going to go to a brothel, this would be the one to go to. All the women are beautiful and The place itself is a fantastic Belle Epoque looking piece of, it's designed the same way as the famous Metro sign in Paris is. You know, when you see the entrance to the Paris Metro with that beautiful Art Nouveau design, it's very much designed along the similar lines to that. If you go to Paris and you're not far away from the Louvre, if you get off the Metro stop near the Louvre, you'll see that beautiful archway they've got over the Metro entrance. And this one is very much in that kind of style. This isn't a deep movie. It isn't like Citizen Kane or anything like that, but it does have a good romping adventure feel. The only other films you could really compare it to are things like those Magnificent Men in their flying machines and films of that kind where you get a whole ensemble of actors. You bring them in for a few days to do some bits and you know that they're going to be quality and bring them in. Now, as the plot of the film progresses, it's discovered that Lord Bostwick and the other members of the Bureau plan to basically cause anarchy in Europe. There's a meeting of all the heads of the various governments in Europe at a castle, and the plan is for Lord Bostwick and his people to steal a Zeppelin from Germany and drop an extremely large conventional bomb onto the castle, thereby causing anarchy, killing all the heads of European countries, and in general letting the shit hit the fan. I'm going to play another bit of audio from the film, which is the first meeting between Dragomilov and Sonya Winter, just to show you that kind of rapport that Oliver Reed and Diana Rigg bring to their acting in this film.
Forgive me, a little test for our customers. We're not used to dealing with ladies.
Evidently.
An interesting reaction. Men come here on the most gruesome business, yet without exception, they're frightened out of their wits by the first whiff of gunpowder. You seem to be made of sterner stuff. Would you please be seated? Miss Winter, you are not married. You have, as far as we can ascertain, no romantic associations. Whom in the world, other than a husband or a lover, could a young lady wish to kill?
You seem to know a great deal about me.
Naturally, or you would not be here.
On my part, at least may I know whom I am addressing?
Sir, I am Ivan Dragomilov. Oh, don't be put off by the name. My father's Russian sentimentality has been amply counteracted by the rigors of an English public school education.
Are you the head of this organization?
Certainly.
You look extremely young.
Oh, well, don't let that worry you. I was born and bred for the job.
But that's terrible.
There's nothing terrible about it. My father brought me up to continue his life work. What could be more natural than for a son to inherit the family business?
Business? You're a gang of murderers.
Our proper title is the Assassination Bureau. Limited. Our dividends are quite substantial.
Dividends? You admit you take human life for money.
Money is life. Don't you agree? The lack of it has killed more people one way or another than 100 assassination bureaus. In any case, human life is possibly the most expendable commodity we possess. It's so easily replaced. And so pleasurably.
The look of this film is really enhanced by the cinematography by Jeffrey Unsworth, a cinematographer who started out as a camera operator for Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger back in the 1940s. And just to look at the films that Unsworth has done as a cinematographer, it's a pretty impressive. He did Hell Drivers, of course, which I mentioned in the last podcast, The 300 Spartans, Beckett, Othello, the 1965 Genghis Khan, 2001 A Space Odyssey, which he did immediately before this film, Cromwell in 1970 with Richard Harris, Cabaret, Murder on the Orient Express, The Abdication, Zardoz, Royal Flash, A Bridge Too Far, first two Superman movies, and The Great Train Robbery. So basically he's great with futuristic stuff like 2001 and also period pieces like Murder on the Orient Express, The Assassination Bureau, of course, and the first Great Train Robbery. So really, really lovely, lush look to this film. And it is a lot of fun. Some of the special effects sequences later on in the film with the Zeppelins suffer compared to modern special effects. There are a few matte lines around them, and the bits where Oliver Reed is hanging off the side of a Zeppelin don't really come together The way they would in a modern film with much better technologies, but it's a bit of fun. There's a sword fight between Kurt Jurgens and Oliver Reed near the gas bags of the Zeppelin. There's some swashes are buckled and buckles are swashed and a lot of that kind of thing. And but not too much else to say about this film, but do see it. It is a bit of fun, and it's nice to see Oliver Reed at the peak of his skills in a lighter role, and he does do the comedy aspects of this quite well. Later on, of course, he did Women in Love and The Devils and things like that, and really cemented his reputation as a character actor. But, of course, he became unreliable due to his alcoholism, which is a shame. I mean, he's one of those actors who really could have done anything he liked had he not drunk and pissed his skills away. Which, of course, is a bit sad. But that's about it. If you have seen it, let me know what you think. If you haven't seen it, do check it out. It is available on Region 1 DVD. So there should be not too much hassle locating a copy of it. And for the 1960s, it was quite an ambitious kind of movie in its own way. An entertainment more than something serious, but well worth the effort. So I'm going to take a break now and get on with the second of the movies I'm going to do today. 1983 Australian film Goodbye Paradise, starring Ray Barrett, Robin Nevin and Guy Dolman, who you might remember from The Ipcress File. Directed by Carl Schultz. That was Agente Speciale Il K by Bruno Nicolai, one of my favourite Italian movie composers of the middle of the 20th century. And let's get on with Goodbye Paradise. This film, as I said, it's one of my favourite Australian films of all time. I saw it first in the cinema in 83 and it didn't do well. I'm pretty sure it didn't do well in Queensland, particularly because of the nature of the film. I'll play a bit of the voiceover narration from the start of this movie just to set the scene for you. One of the things about voiceover narration is that it's very rarely done well. Dick Powell did it well in Murder, My Sweet. There have been a number of cases when it has been done well, but I think a movie like particularly Blade Runner put the frighteners on people using voiceover narration. In this film, it works really well. The protagonist, Michael Stacey, OBE, is telling his story. So the voiceover narration, in that sense, works really well, and it is very well written. But I'll play the first bit, and then I'll talk about the film a little further.
The winter sun was going down on Surface Paradise. It was my 98th day on the wagon. It didn't feel any better than my 97th. I missed my hip flask of Johnny Walker, my ex-wife Jean, my pet dog Samari, and my exorbitant salary as deputy commissioner of police. I wasn't sure anymore. I was cut out to be a writer of controversial exposés of police corruption. At the moment, I couldn't lift the lid off a can of baked beans. I wanted to be 12 years old again, the best spin bowler in Southport High. I wanted a lot of things.
I made my way into the familiar squalor, wondering how I, Michael Stacy, OBE of Army and Police Intelligence, one-time friend of cabinet ministers and brothel keepers and gambling millionaires, had come down so far in the world so fast. It was to do in part, I knew, with being framed in the Royal Commission, but maybe it went deeper than that. Maybe I had a suicidal streak, one that got worse when sober. I was thankful at least for the weekly postcard from my old mate Quiney in Malaya, on which was the latest move in our absorbing game of chess. The game now in its seventh month was beginning to look interesting.
Then I wrote some more of my forthcoming bestseller that exposed them all, the bastards. Wished I was writing it better. And then real life and truth. I was getting to like it less and less.
So that's basically it. A dishonored ex-police commissioner, deputy police commissioner, is writing an expose, and he gets a call from an old friend of his, Les McCready, who's now a cabinet minister in the federal government, to find his runaway daughter, Kathy, whom Stacey is the godfather of. He used to like Kathy, and they knew each other when she was a child, so... Partly because his publisher is not too fond of the book and is being pressured for him not to write it, Stacey takes the money and takes the job of locating Kathy McCready. And that is where the story starts. It evolves going through high-tech 1980s-style New Age cults and a hippie commune in the hinterland above Canungra. Army barracks and a number of other seedy characters, art dealers in Surfers Paradise, which is a place just below Brisbane. It's one of the tackiest places I've ever been to, and yes, I have been to Los Angeles. Surfers Paradise has its own kind of tacky. All of the park benches in Surfers Paradise are shaped like surfboards because, of course, it's Surfers Paradise. And, it's a tourist thing. All the equivalent of spring break we have here is schoolies. All of the teenagers from everywhere go to Surfers Paradise for schoolies that can get cheap grog. And basically, the place is the worst excesses of capitalism that you're going to see. It's kind of like a micro Las Vegas without the gambling. But anyway, the movie itself is set... Well, it was filmed in 1983, just in the middle of the Bjelke-Petersen government in Queensland. The Bjelke-Petersen government was arguably the most complete police state of a state government that Australia's ever seen. You couldn't get a protest march permit, and if you tried to march without a permit, the cops would beat the shit out of you and arrest you. They fought Aboriginal groups buying up large tracts of lands in northern Queensland to... basically repossess their own land. They put laws in place to stop that. They put laws in place to when the National Trust put up a protection order against a historic building. The state government would allow the developers to come at night time and knock the building down when no one was looking. And in between 1957 and 1975, and this is my favourite statistic about Queensland politics, between 57 and 75, there was not one new school constructed in the whole state of Queensland, which is about the size of Texas, maybe bigger, probably bigger. So basically, it's a deep white north. It was racist. It was draconian. There were deals. The police were incredibly politicized. There were deals between property developers and the state government. There was a Royal Commission into Corruption where police commissioners got put away. All of this happened in about 1987, 1988, just as the Bjelke-Petersen government was ending. But basically, the whole place was a hotbed of vice and corruption. And there was a collusion between business, the police, the government, and various religious organizations to basically keep a lid on anybody who disagreed with what was being done to the state of Queensland. That's since changed. There have been a number of royal commissions, and Queensland has improved somewhat. But 4 years after this film was made is when the shit really hit the fan for these people, and the corruption was brought out. Now, the film was written by Bob Ellis, who is one of the best political writers in Australia and has been for the last 30 years. And the film was shown at the 2005 Melbourne International Film Festival with Bob Ellis and his co-writer Denny Lawrence in attendance. Basically, Denny wanted to make a movie in the style of a Raymond Chandler novel, but set in Australia. Bob liked the traditional film noir character, but he wanted to give it an Australian kind of twist to it. They had decided they were going to use a couple of Tom Waits songs in the movies, but the producer wanted to, the dramatic and the overblown orchestral score that ended up being in the film, rather than giving it that kind of Tom Waitsy kind of feel. And I'm reading off a website here, which shows the Q&A with Bob Ellis and Denny Lawrence about this film in 2005. And the film almost didn't go ahead because of lack of funding, but in the 11th hour, they wrote a telegram to the New South Wales Premier at the time, Neville Wran, who was a Labor Party Premier, whereas Joe Bjelke-Petersen and his government were Country Party. And basically, they wrote a telegram to Neville Wran saying they had a great story about that decadent enclave just across the border to your north. And Neville Wran personally delivered them a check from the New South Wales Film Corporation. So, it's an interesting film. The producer of the film, Jane Scott, with whom Bob Ellis had a lot of problem, ended up being the producer of the movie Shine, the one that got Jeffrey Rush the Academy Award in about 1996. Basically the film is, it's a kind of slight, they say in this website it's an alternate universe, but basically it's a story where there's a big push to make the Gold Coast a new state of Australia, to separate it from Queensland and turn it into a new state, because there's lots of mineral resources there. There's lots of market gardens. They're incredibly rich in natural resources. And a group of business people, along with certain military interests, get together and decide they're going to make the Gold Coast a new state of Australia so they can have their own state government and do the things they want to do. But their plans are a lot more malicious than that. So Stacey eventually finds Kathy MacReady, and through finding her, the full extent of this plot, basically they're not even going to make the Gold Coast a new state, they're going to have a coup d'etat and form their own country with it. There's some military exercises with certain Asian countries going on in the area, and behind the scenes they've plotted and planned to basically take over the Gold Coast and turn it into another country. And Stacey, because some of his old friends, including an old military mate of his from Malaya, there was a Malaya crisis in about 1960, 1962, where Australian soldiers went to Malaya, as it was then Malaysia now, and helped out with some communist insurgents. So Stacey's old mate, Quiney, played by Guy Dolman, who you might remember played the boss of Michael Caine's Harry Palmer character in all of the early Harry Palmer movies, is part of that coup. He gets a couple of really good scenes there. He's almost unrecognisable because he's got a moustache and a military hat on, but you can recognise the voice. And they have some quite interesting dialogue between them. I'll play another little audio grab from it. This is the bit where Stacey's being taken up through all of the canals and the weirdly named areas behind Surfers Paradise, where they basically built a network of canals and things for rich people to have houses on. All of the names that he mentions in this part are the proper names for these areas. It shows you the kind of verbal excess that property developers are heir to.
I had a mouth like an Ayatollah's armpit and a pressing need for a drink. I could have argued, but frankly I was curious. We went upriver from the Isle of Capri, past bungalow after bungalow of rich men, waiting for the eternal boatman on their summer lawns, avoided the Rialto, turned right at Sorrento, and went on past the portals of Orion into Shangri-La Estate. Les MacReady had come up in the world from when I knew him first, a class below me in Southport High, where he fielded like a stud mullet at leg slip. Stormont and Packer, law graduate, local alderman, Queen's Counsel, federal senator, and cabinet minister, and now tipped to be premier of the emerging seventh state. And it'd be nice to say he hadn't changed a bit, but he had. A lot of it was the Labour Party caucus, you couldn't blame him for that. And part of it was his new wife, a social climbing air hostess with designs on Buckingham Palace.
She looked 10 years younger since her hysterectomy, and mean as a beach full of blue bottles.
I like that bit. For those of you who don't know, blue bottles are little blue jellyfish that sting on beaches. So, basically, the whole thing about the film, from Denny Lawrence and Bob Ellis's viewpoint, they wanted to make it an Australian noir film, but they wanted to make it as Australian as possible. There are lots of Australian references in there, which a lot of people may have to look up if they watch the film. I'll probably go on now to tell you why I like it. There's a number of reasons. Well, I like it because the dialogue is fantastic and witty. And even in the third act, where the coup starts to take place and Stacy is basically a non-compos mentis for most of it, it's a really interesting Australian film, and it's got an audacity. It doesn't kind of accept the status quo. It goes off at a tangent and says, yes, there are discontented people out there and they may have some power and they may start to try to do something about it. Nobody in the rest of Australia liked the Queensland government at the time. It was incredibly ugly, and because there's a certain power that state governments have within the Australian Federation, it was incredibly difficult to stop certain kinds of human rights abuses from occurring in Queensland, and to stop certain deals. Since the Royal Commission, it's been made clear that that's not the best way to go, and that there can be, if you do have an incredibly corrupt government, eventually somebody will catch you and put you in jail. Bjorky Peterson himself never went to jail, but he was brought close to it at various times by the Royal Commissions and by various court cases. Some people... he was very litigious as well. He'd sue people for slander and that, and because the courts and, of course, the police in Queensland were very politicised, it was very difficult not to be hammered by the legal system at the time. It's a little known piece of Australian history. It's not one we're particularly proud of, but Goodbye Paradise addresses it more directly than any other work of Australian fiction of any kind at the time. And it does... wickedly satirise it. There's the sleazy corruption of various political parties, including the Labor Party. He mentions the Labor caucus in that audio grab I did before. It's a kind of zeitgeisty thing. It's very much in the feel of its time. It tells us what things were like in the 1980s in Queensland without being a documentary. The corruption, the rich people banding together to create something tacky and ugly, but very, very lucrative. And Stacy himself as a character is interesting. He does have alcoholic blackouts at various times in the film. He has a on-again, off-again relationship with Kate, played by Robin Nevin, a very fine Australian actor, who now is very important in the theatrical community, particularly in Sydney. And one of the things for trivia buffs and movie geeks, her current partner and her long-term partner, they've been together for about 20 years, is Nicholas Hammond, whom you might remember played Spider-Man in the 1970s Spider-Man TV series that went on very briefly. He was also in Sound of Music as one of the kids. So there you go. The movie people all around the world are connected in various ways. So Robin Nevin's very good in it. There's also another really great piece of acting by, and not really an actor, Sir Ted Godfrey, one of the military heads that you see in the film, is played by Tex Morton, who was an Australian country singer of long established reputation. This was probably his first and his last acting roles, and he's taking an interest in Stacey's goings-on during the film. And he has some wickedly wonderful dialogue and does it really, really well. It's a pity he didn't do more acting, because Ted Godfrey is a fantastic character. There are a number of other people in the film that Australians will know. Kate Fitzpatrick's in it, playing the woman who's as mean as a beach full of blue bottles. She's had a very long career in Australian stage and film. John Clayton's in it. He's an Australian character actor. He plays the head of the hippie commune, an ex-Australian military intelligence guy who's gone and seen what the CIA can do in the States, and come back and decided to create a utopian hippie community in the hinterland behind the Gold Coast. And, of course, as I said, Guy Dolman. Paul Chubb's in it as well. Paul Chubb, who died a few years ago, is an Australian character actor. If you see Australian films from the 70s to the 90s, Paul Chubb will inevitably turn up in them. He's kind of a, unfortunately, his name was Chubb, but he is a chubby character, a balding, curly-haired actor. But he's always really good in film, in those character roles, and playing somebody who's not particularly too bright at times, but he has had a wider range of roles. If you look through it, he did get a little bit stereotyped, but towards the end of his career, he did a couple of roles that really kind of stepped out of that stereotype, and it was good to see before his untimely death that that did occur. The music isn't the best. It I would have preferred to have seen a different one. It's music's pretty dated, but it's the movie takes you through all sorts of different places in Queensland. It takes you through the bush. It takes you through the sleazy nightclubs around Surfers Paradise. It takes you into the homes of the rich. It takes you into Stacey's ramshackle little boarding house with his landlady, played by Carol Skinner, another fine Australian actor who turns up in movies occasionally. But the overwhelming arc of the film and the story of the film is about Stacey's epiphany, Stacey coming to terms with what's occurred and the stage he is in his life. His relationship with Kate helps him with that to a certain extent, and I won't do any spoilers on how the relationship goes. He's basically a cat's paw for the people who are investigating this potential coup d'etat in Queensland, and his understanding of that and his understanding of the reasons why the coup came about and the reasons why people were fighting it, and the understanding that there's this line he does in the film saying, old friends are the necessary heretics, they keep a good man humble. And unfortunately, he's being an old friend of people like Quiney and the John Clayton character doesn't keep them humble. They've drifted off. And another line he says about John Clayton's character in the film is, he's the boy I knew, but not the man I knew. A lot of different characters in this film are trying to recapture their youth in various ways, and with dramatic and disastrous effect on other people. So there's that interesting arc along there, and it's a beautiful piece of writing to be able to convey that within the context of basically a political satire, come film noir, come whatever you call it. It's a movie that slightly defies genre, and I think at the time that's one of the reasons why it wasn't successful. People at the time were making period piece movies in Australia to a large extent, or domestic dramas. They were kind of going the Mike Lee kind of movies all the time, or else they were going over the top and doing Mad Max films, which were basically aimed for an international market. There weren't any really Australian stories being told that were also going further and going into the realm of satire and into ridicule, and but actually saying something important about the Australian character and about some things that were going on in Queensland in politics at the time. It was a film that covered a lot of bases, but it wasn't easy to pigeonhole. So the critics at the time and the people who distributed the film at the time really didn't have an easy niche to put it into when they were advertising it. There were some advertisements on the, particularly on television, for the film. And in fact, you can find some of them on YouTube, which don't tell you a lot about the film. They don't kind of explain what it is very well at all. They give you a couple of flashy visuals of the battle scenes, which are rightly ridiculous, because they, in the context of the film, they are ridiculous battles. Really, they didn't carry the film well. I went to see it because I'd heard a couple of whispers about it, and a friend of mine at the time decided we were going to see it, and I was very much into Australian films, still am to an extent, but I think there are so many disappointing Australian films, it's a little hard to keep enthused at times about viewing. In retrospect, and since the 2005 showing in the Melbourne International Film Festival, the film's reputation has increased. The Australian Film Archive, the National Film Archive, is trying to piece together a new print of the film, because getting a good copy of it and getting a reliable, definitive print is difficult. It was made by a small company at the time, Petersham Films, so the originals are a little hard to source, but the National Film Archive is putting together a definitive copy, and I hope at some stage it does come out on DVD, the way a film like Wake in Fright did. It's a worthwhile film, and it's an important piece of Australian film history. You can find it, and I'll name check where you can find it if you do have a membership to Cinemageddon. You can find it on there in a VHS copy. One of the other things, the trivia things that I wanted to mention about the film, Stacey has a black dog called Samari. The dog's name is in itself a joke because the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea at the time, and indeed still to this day, is Sir Michael Samari, who is politically, basically is corrupt. In the movie, they satirise Samari by making a black dog called Samari, Stacey's pet. One of the most treasured artefacts of Australian film that I have the VHS cover of Goodbye Paradise, and on the inside of the cover, on the white part on the inside, I've got Ray Barrett's autograph, and it says, "To Terry, all the best, Ray Barrett and Samari." So that's one I'm not letting go of. Unfortunately, Ray Barrett died a couple of years ago, and he is one of Australia's treasures in acting. If you want to see him in another role, if you go back to look up his name in the context of Hammer horror films, he was in films like The Gorgon and a couple of other Hammer films. He did work a lot in the 1960s in the UK, and he does show, it's really interesting seeing Ray Barrett watching Goodbye Paris and then seeing him again in some Hammer horror films. And I'll give you a list of which ones to look for, just so you can kind of see the arc of this guy's career. I apologise, I misspoke. Ray Barrett was in one of the Hammer horror films, The Reptile. It wasn't The Gorgon. It was The Reptile in 1966. So he was in that. He was also one of the voices on the TV series Thunderbirds. He played John Tracy, amongst other things. Apparently, I heard him say that one of the things they did was, they were all jobbing actors who did the Thunderbirds voiceovers. They'd do it all on a Sunday, and at lunchtime, they'd all head down to the pub and come back and do the rest of the voiceovers. And half of the actors were pissed as newts when they were doing the voices for the Thunderbirds. So that's about it for Goodbye Paradise. I do recommend that people see it. It is a great piece of Australiana. It's an incredibly underestimated film too. I watched it every few years since it first came out, and I do treasure the film, and I keep seeing new things into it each time. There's some wonderful little sly things, like Kathy McCready walking through the bushland on the hippie commune, and she's pulling an apple off a tree, and a snake slithers past her feet as she's carrying a basket full of apples and offers Stacey an apple, things like that. There are some audacious choices in her and some lovely little bits of satire. So I'm not going to talk any more about the film. I think it's a great film. I think it's well worth anyone seeing, and I have a real fondness for it, above pretty much any other Australian film that I know of. Going to take another break now, and when I come back, we'll do the feedback.
Oh,
That was Lucky Bosser again by Bruno Nicolai. Both of those tracks that I played were from old Eurospy movies. And I'm back on the Eurospy kick again, so I'm really enjoying the 1960s glamour of minor actors, dubbed dialogue, and chicks in bikinis. The only real feedback we've got this time, and I can understand this time of year why we haven't got more, is from the inimitable Dr. Zom. Adding to his repertoire of accents. And before we start, Zom, I know you've been unwell, mate, so I do hope you get better soon, and I hope that that enormous dumping of snow, sleet, ice, thunder, lightning, cats and dogs living together that you guys had on the east coast of the States isn't fucking you up more than it absolutely has to. Anyway, here's Zom's voicemail, and he does add another accent and another imitation of a famous person to his repertoire.
Der Frost, das ist Dr. Zom. Calling from the United States of America. Calling to speak to you about an actor and a movie. And the actor is Greg Peck. The movie, I Walk the Line, 1970, John Frankenheimer. This movie also stars very young Tuesday Weld, Estelle Parsons, Ralph Meeker, and also Charles Durning as the slimy, conniving, butthole deputy, Greg Peck. And if I continue to speak like Greg Peck throughout this voicemail, it would be quite long. So, I'm going to switch over to the cool and stylish voice of Dr. Zom. Terry Frost. This is a movie I just, it's a kind of a forgotten gem. I don't know if you've seen it or not. I haven't seen it for quite a while. I remember viewing it as a wee sprig when I was very young with my mom and dad. It was shown on network TV on one of those Sunday night at the movie deals or whatever in prime time, which they used to do back in the old days, which seemed to get further and further away as the hair in my nose and the hair on my ears grow rapidly and grow gray. So anyway, I remember at the time being a little kid, and you know, I loved Johnny Cash, and he was huge in the early 70s. And but I remember watching this movie, and Johnny Cash did, you know, pretty much all the songs in the movie. And but I remember being so disappointed in this movie because it was called I Walk the Line, and I thought, you know, Johnny Cash, and I loved that song, and Johnny Cash wasn't even in it. Oh my God! And this movie, I just didn't understand it. But, you know, now, being an older, wiser, and more experienced gentleman, I really appreciate the movie, and I appreciate that it is quite unconventional, and you had the stoic hero, Greg Peck, who, you know, was known for playing the greatest father in movie history, Atticus Finch. Not being, you know, very Atticus Finch-like. But anyway, I just wanted to give you a call and wish you a happy holidays, whatever holidays, you pagan, godless creatures celebrate. And what is it, Sir Isaac Newton Day? I'm not sure. But anyway, it's a good idea. And I hope that the paleo cinema carries on throughout 2011 and into the future. Good day, sir. Good day to Sal, and good day to the many kitties. Kitties, not kiddies. Meow. This is Dr. Zom, calling from the United States of America, saying Zom whoop.
Thanks for that, Zom. I'm going to have to check out Walk the Line. I did see it many moons ago, pretty much as you did, and I probably should revisit it. If I'm not mistaken, was Tuesday Weld in that one? Let me just see what I've got there. I Walk the Line movie. I'm typing this in as we speak. Okay, let's see what I've got there. No, they're doing all the Walk the Line crap. Let's see what I've got here. I think I know who's in this one with Greg Peck. But I'll just check and see. And, of course, my internet thing goes slowly. All I'm getting is that shit about the Johnny Cash biopic. Just give me a moment. Yep, I was right. Tuesday World was in that one. I wonder if this would make a good companion piece, like a double feature with that other great Tuesday World movie. Let me just see. Which was Pretty Poison. Yeah, that could probably be a pretty good combination, those two together. So, yeah, thanks for that, Zom. I'm going to find a copy and I'm going to watch it, and I'll let you know. Always like your recommendations. I do have a copy of The Honeymoon Killers. I picked it up since you recommended The Honeymoon Killers to me, but I haven't had a chance to watch it, you know, like real life. Taking care of new kittens and other stuff has kind of curtailed my movie viewing to a certain extent. The other thing we did get, which is groovy, is we did get in the post-Christmas sales a great big 32-inch flat screen for the front room and another Blu-ray player. We picked up a good Blu-ray player for $99, which in Australia is a pretty good deal. Picked up some more Blu-rays as well. I got both the Grindhouse movies on Blu-ray. Let's see, we got Shaun of the Dead on Blu-ray. We also got Hot Fuzz. There were some deals on those as well. So I'm running out of space on my Blu-ray shelf, so I'm going to have to expand that into some other area. But thanks for that, Zom. I will let you know. I should sit down and watch Honeymoon Killers and that in this kind of post-Christmas, pre-New Year malaise that we all suffer through. Outside, the weather's actually got pretty good, so I'm going to brag a little bit on the weather, given the fact that there have been snowstorms in the Northern Hemisphere. Not a cloud in the sky, great weather for drying the clothes on the clothesline and getting out and about. So, them's the breaks, kids. Anyway, I'm going to leave it there. I'll be back in 2 weeks with something else. I'm going to try to step out of my comfort zone with a movie or two next time around, but don't keep me to that. So anyway, enjoy your movie viewing. I hope that if the weather is extreme where you are, that you and your family and everybody you know stay safe. I really don't want to get any bad news in that regard. And but I think maybe you should reconsider living on a continent that's attached to one of the poles of the planet. I can't see any good coming out of that in any circumstance. You've really got to have a cordon of water between you and polar regions to really enjoy a temperate climate. And people across Eurasia and North America don't seem to have that approach to things. We here in the Southern Hemisphere, of course, have a much more sensible approach to geography. Anyway, that's about it. Enjoy your movie viewing. Drop me a line at the usual things. And one of the things I should do this time around is thank Sal for all of her support in 2010. She did the voiceovers, as you know, but she also gives me a lot of back of house support as well. We negotiate the time and the space for me to do this podcast, and she really is the unsung hero of the whole deal. So thank you for that, Sal, and I will be back in a fortnight. Catch you later.